You are listening to Radiant Creators, a collaborative project composed of people whose passion, purpose, and dedication requires forging their own unique path of empowerment and livelihood. A Radiant Creator isn't making a living, they are living. Arthur Haynes is a botanist who founded the Delta Institute of Natural History in Canton, Maine, where he teaches human ecology, focusing on the values of foraging, wildcrafting medicine, and primitive living skills. Arthur has published major textbooks, has named multiple new species and genera to science, and has helped construct websites that enable people to identify plants throughout the northeastern U.S. Arthur helps people learn to foster awareness, connection, health, and self-reliance through an understanding of ancestral and existing indigenous cultures. Welcome, Arthur.
You definitely live a unique life dedicated to the ancestral path and bringing that forth. What was the spark that prompted you to be Arthur Haynes, to do the work that you're doing?
Well, that's a great question, Craig.
Thanks a lot.
And it's one I'm not sure that I've been asked in that way before. It was a long path of essentially coming around to understanding that we are, in fact, animals, that we are not sort of our own type of organism that is elevated above everything else. And as animals, we have an evolutionary history where this creates biological needs based on what our ancestors encountered in their environments. And as I began to move forward on a path of trying to attain, you know, health, I was eating the standard American diet. And, you know, while I was very active and always spending time outdoors, practicing primitive living skills and being involved in natural history and tracking, there were a lot of things around my diet and my medicine, even some parts of my worldview where, you know, I was very much engaged in modern living. And like most people who do that, I was beginning to suffer health problems. And each one of these health problems, as they arose through a process, I came to correct these issues and heal these issues through connecting with our ancestral norms. And I've come to understand that, again, our history as a species has created these needs in modern humans. We have a need for a certain level of nutrition. We have a need to move each day. We have a need to have a kind of water quality and an air quality, a need to interact with other humans in a really beneficial way. And just the more that I looked into these ancestral patterns, the more I realized that they're fundamentally who we still are today.
That sounds wonderful, because it seems like it would be an evolving path. It isn't something to just wake up one day and start. And so I imagine it's still an evolutionary path. I mean, you're kind of just getting started.
Yeah, and it's a path that requires some study. You, as a person who's living in this contemporary world, you don't just wake up and say, I'm going to try to emulate ancestral patterns, because we don't even know what they are without study. And we've also been trained to believe that we are living in the best time that humans have ever had, something that I think can be soundly shown to be incorrect. But we have to get past some of these obstacles that stand in the way of us of reconnecting with our ancestral norms.
I like that. And when you mentioned that this is not the best time that humans have ever lived, what would be an example of what was a better time? When were we more healthy and strong?
Well, I mean, we can certainly demonstrate that there were various aspects of our health that were much better if we were to examine indigenous people prior to contact. And I'm not talking about going back 10, 12, 50, 100,000 years ago, but I'm talking about those indigenous people that may have been contacted in just the last centuries. I mean, they had an amazing resilience to chronic disease and things that are very common here in the United States. Let's look at cancer that will afflict 2 in 5 people in this country over their lifetime. That's something where the incidence was virtually zero. Heart disease, half of the people in this country over the age of 45 are in some stage of cardiovascular disease. Again, indigenous people prior to disruptive contact were shown to have a high resilience to this with, you know, again, a near zero incidence of this, and so on and so forth. Diabetes, depression, suicide. We have all these kinds of things that we can show that wild people did better than we do. And let's also look at how they view and interact with the earth as a really important way of just demonstrating they really felt themselves as part of the earth, much like, you know, if we were to use the analogy of the human body, the finger doesn't feel that it's separate and has dominion over the rest of the human body. It's all part of the same thing. And that was how indigenous people viewed themselves. They were part of this planet, part of this mega organism that we might refer to as the Earth Mother or Gaia. You know, one of the great examples I like to use, Craig, is violence. And if you were to talk to people like Steven Pinker or Jared Diamond, they would describe this as the most peaceful period in the history of humanity and would go back in time to examine some of the battles that have happened in conflicts between indigenous people. And they would point out, now they would use a very specific statistic, and what they would use is the proportion of the population to die during some of these conflicts that either had been observed or could be reconstructed by anthropologists. And, you know, sometimes it was a significant part of the population that happened during these rare conflicts. You might have 10 or 15% or more of an entire population dying. Of course, that was easy to attain when you had very small tribe size of, you know, frequently fewer than 50 people existing in these small bands. Now, we have to use the proportion of people dying to arrive at this idea that they were more violent than we are. Because if we use the total number of people dying, well, you know, look at the Vietnam conflict. That was about 1,300,000 people when we look at combatants and civilians combined. Or what if we were to look at the number of people dying per unit time? I mean, often indigenous conflicts, when they occurred, were very similar to other wild animal conflicts. There were displays and lots of showmanship trying to essentially, you know, intimidate and get others to back down, because wounds to wild animals who need to be able to hunt and move and gather, whether we're talking about wolves, bears, or humans, these are, you know, potentially life-ending injuries that would come with these kinds of clashes. So there was a tremendous amount of showmanship where sometimes in an 8-hour period, there might only be a few people who actually suffered injury or died because of all of the, you know, this, the dancing that was occurring and I'm just lacking the word here to describe it, but the, again, that showmanship and that displays of aggression to try to hopefully get, you know, the people that they were interacting with to back down. So if we look at it in terms of total numbers of deaths or number of people who might die per unit time, or even how about the continents involved? I mean, with modern warfare, we have people cross oceans to engage in conflicts that don't even have any impact to the people living in those areas. And so what I'm trying to get at here, Craig, is we really live in a very violent time, but we will spin the statistics in such a way to continue promoting this idea, this worldview, as I like to call it, that we are living in this very peaceful time and that we definitely would have never wanted to live in another time period. Now, that may all be true because we have some really fantastic things that I would not want to be without, like life-saving trauma medicine. I mean, we have an ability to do amazing things to organ systems that have been in traumatic accidents, or somebody has experienced a fall from a very great height, or whatever the case is. It's not that everything is bad today. That's not what I'm trying to say. It's that we have lost some of the strengths that we had in a previous time. And what I would like to see us do is to be able to merge those so that we have the strengths of the old and the strengths of the new.
I like that. Well, especially how you mentioned modern medicine, or you might say Western medicine. I view it as a tool to use with your own discernment. So it's not all bad. I mean, if I break my leg, I'm definitely going to a trauma center because we're really good at it. I mean, especially with all the wars we're fighting, we've learned how to treat trauma very well in this country. I mean, so I don't know where you could go better, you know. And
yeah, I couldn't agree more, Craig. But let's be clear, if I have chronic disease, if I'm dealing with diabetes or heart disease, Western medicine is the last thing I want, because it cannot cure. It only treats the symptoms that are being presented by those chronic diseases. In fact, it never even looks at the root cause of how to prevent them, and simply puts people on various prescription drugs, or whether it be insulin shots, depending on what chronic disease we're talking about, and just sets them up for a lifetime of dependency on Western medicine. What I'm getting at is, even within the topic field of Western medicine, which is this very powerful healing modality, we also have some serious shortcomings where, if we could combine what we know wild people were capable of doing through the prevention garnered by their diet, their lifestyle, their community, their movement, and so on, we would have a very powerful way of creating health and maintaining health in humans.
Definitely. I've seen the frustration in doctors that I've known, where I think, you know, many are catching on and they want to go deeper. They want to tickle the immune system with the proper feather to adjust it. But unfortunately, all they have is a sawed-off shotgun. And
yes,
they treat everything like with a kind of medical blunt trauma, you might say, and just beat on it. And I see their frustration, because I think a lot of doctors, especially now, they're starting to know better. But I mean, in that field, they're very controlled with violence. Something I've noticed is that in the past, before, you know, disruptive contact, you might say, such a state of mind where there are others that are completely evil. That's something I see today in our culture, that we have such a concept of others, and then the others are not even human. And I don't know if that's really natural, that tribal culture, indigenous culture, would see other tribes as truly not human, as such an so intensely others, so disconnected with other humans.
Yeah, and you know, from what we understand or believe we understand, you know, from anthropologists and their interviews with indigenous people, it certainly varied. I mean, we do know that there were lots of groups who practice xenogamy, in other words, outmarriage, and you can't view your neighbors as filthy or evil or worthless or inhuman if you're going to send off part of your relatives, part of your relations to marry and live with these people. So it certainly wasn't the sort of, it seems to be today in many cases, this universal, we are more important than every other country. Our religion is the one true religion, and they have it wrong.
Yeah,
we are worth special privilege. They are not. And it's a really hard place to be, because we're forgetting that all of these other people are also part of the biosphere. And, you know, essentially what we do to these people, we're also suffering from this as well. I mean, whether you are the oppressed or the oppressor, you suffer.
Exactly. It's the same game, just two different sides.
Yes.
With disruptive contact, before then, there was less depression. And it reminds me of a book called, it's by Sebastian Younger. It's just called Tribe. He talks about people in the military coming back and then tending to commit suicide from PTSD, where they didn't commit suicide and they weren't as depressed when they were in the military. But then when they return to civilian life, they can't handle it. And he kind of breaks it down to truly, within their tribal culture, the depression didn't exist so much and they had support. So it's almost like what soldiers are suffering from who return from war, they lost their tribe, and that might be a part of PTSD that we're not looking at. So I find that interesting too.
And that's certainly true, Craig. I mean, when we look at intact indigenous cultures who still have their diet, their life ways, their ceremonies, their lands, their communities intact, we notice a phenomenal contentedness, and we can go so far as to often refer to that as a happiness that these people share because they have a unified purpose. They had harvest sharing. In other words, food being shared. The details of that sharing differed by various groups, but there was a distribution of food that was being brought back from their landscape. And it created this real unifying force where even when people may have been suffering hunger, not to create some image that, you know, hunter-gatherers were always on the verge of starvation. They were actually more resilient to starvation than many agriculturalists have ever been. But when there were periods of hunger or extreme temperatures like the deep cold, or importantly, a loss of elders or a loss of family members, whether this was due to age or some other mishap, I mean, we had effective ways of managing, dealing with, exploring, and ultimately enduring the grief that came with these different types of stresses that people were involved in. And what happens as Sebastian Junger was describing, with people returning from, you know, armed conflicts where they were dealing with, you know, situations that I can't possibly hope to ever imagine, nor do I ever want to be in those situations. One of those times that, you know, if we have to have these armed conflicts, I'm just going to say that I'm immensely thankful for the people that are willing to go to that length to protect people that they've never even met. And while they're doing that, there's a sense of unity that is lost when they come back to the United States, where we are so fractured along religious, political, and social lines that we do not function as a common voice. And perhaps that's not even realistic to assume that hundreds of millions of people can do this. But we are certainly very, very divided, and it's new to our existence. We have always had amazing unity within our villages.
So you're working on a new book called A New Path that I heard about when you were talking to Daniel Fidelis on his podcast. So he defined it as a sequentially laid out guidebook covering the Neo-Aboriginal lifestyle in an incredibly comprehensive way. That sounds like a great book. How's that coming?
Yes, it is. This is a book that is all written. And in fact, there was a small release to an online book club where we read and discussed this, but now it's going to the printer. It's 364 pages. It's a fairly large book. It begins with sort of an introduction of the modern human situation and trying to tease apart some of the, you know, those glittery worldviews that we have, looking at the relevance of Indigenous lifeways because they are our wild ancestors, because we originate from them. The biological needs that they have are also the biological needs that we have. And then we simply go through this book rather than simply talking about diet and movement or, you know, diet and religion or whatever the case might be. I wanted to try to lay out a much more holistic look at some of the things that humans need. And no book can cover all of these things, but this one looks at diet, water, medicine, our awareness, movement, hormesis, that ability to expand comfort zones, and really importantly, talks about community and what are the ancestral versions of our community, what they looked like, and how our modern versions essentially fail in most of the characters that defined ancestral communities. And then there's a few other things, some discussion of primitive technology and how this fosters self-reliance and maybe how we can walk a little more softly in the marketplace. And then really ends with some deeper philosophy on rewilding and the obstacles that stand in the way to us living more as wild humans and less as domesticated humans.
One chapter you mentioned about feral movement. What is like the natural exercise for a human? Because it seems like going to a gym and working out mechanically and many movements that we do, even possibly yoga, they're not really our natural form of exercise. And when we see indigenous people, especially the less interrupted they've been, which often we see in pictures more so than, you know, real life today, they look like Olympic athletes. They're incredibly strong. And it seems that your average person today who's going to the gym and working their arms and getting strong probably couldn't beat one of their recent ancestors in an arm wrestling match. How does the individual who's rewilding and who wants to be strong, how do you naturally make your body strong? And I know that's a huge topic, but just if there's any sort of quick answer on that one, and we'll read the book to find out more detail, of course.
Well, to begin with, let's be clear that we don't move enough. We've outsourced our movement, right? Fossil fuel powered machines and migrant laborers do a lot of the work that we would have been doing. And we also don't get enough diversity of movement. We might walk, but we might not be using our upper body that much. We're not at home cracking nuts with a hammer stone, or for that matter, even just using some hand crank device for it. If we want to mix things up, we have a power mixer. We don't do it by hand. I mean, all of these things are just movement that we have lost. It isn't all about hardcore exercise and how many pull-ups you can do. It's really about a variety of movement. We have to remember that we have this material in our body, this called lymph, and it is this fluid that is actually, we have more of it than we do blood, and yet we don't seem to really care about how this gets around. And of course, the main way that this moves throughout our body is by the mechanical motion that we have, the contraction of muscles that pushes this through the lymph system. And lymph is very important for our cleansing, for dealing with all kinds of immune issues. And when we don't move it, our immune system falters. And so it's interesting to think that simply by sitting too much, our immune system begins to fail. So we need more movement, and we need a much greater diversity of movement. And right now, we're definitely stuck in the mindset that, okay, I need to go to the gym, and I'm going to do these reps today. And then I'm going to come home, and I'm going to do my whatever it is, this particular activity. And in all cases, it seems, these are disconnected from real living. In other words, I drove to the gym, I did this, I came home, I did some more exercise. And instead, we never took our life and looked at how artificial all of these activities actually are. We go to work and we earn money to buy our food. And instead, maybe we could have spent time moving on our landscapes, using our legs, using our arms to climb, jumping across things, wading through things, ducking under things to find the foods that we need, and then come home and process them with our arms, with our hands, and get that movement in. And now our movement is directly connected to real living, instead of work to make money to go buy food. And because that job was a seated, sedentary job all day, now we have to drive to the gym and get this intense workout in to make up for the fact that we hadn't done anything all day. By combining these things together and having this less artificial life, if you will, I'm going to use movement to do things that I need, whether that be splitting wood, carrying water, accessing my landscape to find food, brain tanning deer hides. This is one of the ways that we make clothing here at our home. And it's a workout. And we get to have clothing that came from a source that left the forest standing. And all of this because we're trying to pile on top, if you will, the activities that we need to do and kill multiple birds with one stone. I'm going to get my movement and do something for my real world living at the same time.
Wow. So we're kind of trying to replace maybe 10 or 12 hours a day of living in your body fully with 30 minutes of cardio at the gym. Doesn't quite work.
One of the things, Craig, that you see a lot is, you know, people will hold up an image of an Olympic athlete and an image of a hunter-gatherer, and they'll say, look at the muscle development, look at this Olympic athlete, we are stronger than they are. And what they'll do is they'll often take a contacted tribe, and you can tell because they're wearing Nike sneakers and t-shirts with, you know, some fancy saying on it. In other words, these are people who no longer practice the full complement of their indigenous ways. They're probably also, they have been displaced from their homeland, or they're living on a much smaller reservation where they've had to start practicing agriculture and they have become more sedentary. And these comparisons are so odd. They're so faulty and so obviously faulty. You have a wild human, this indigenous person, who has the constraints every day of needing to hydrate themselves and feed themselves and clothe and shelter themselves. And they're doing all that, and they're still robustly strong. We know this from lots of studies that have been done, whether we're looking at bone density or inferring muscle mass based on the attachment points where connective tissue was attached to the bone. The greater the muscle mass, the more prominent these connection points need to be to prevent connective tissue from tearing free from the bone. And we know that hunter-gatherers had much more prominent connection points on the bones than do modern humans. But then we compare them against an Olympic athlete, which is a subsidized human. They are funded by the rest of society, essentially, so that they don't need to feed themselves. Water is piped to them. Clothes are given to them. They do nothing but practice their particular kind of movement on a daily basis. And hopefully the listeners can see how apples to oranges this comparison is. It's simply not comparing similar things. If we were to take fully wild humans, and we could bring them into that Olympic setting, should they even want to, we might have seen a much more fair comparison, but we've never done that. And we certainly know that even if, a modern weightlifter, power lifter who could beat most anybody, perhaps even all of these wild humans, these indigenous people living their intact lifeways, in arm wrestling, would they also be able to travel many kilometers a day, hungry, possibly thirsty, dealing with inclement weather, biting insects, hard terrain, whatever the case is? Could they do all of that in addition to being these, you know, having these amazingly strong arms? And the point is probably no, because to get to that point, they've had to let so much of their life go, so much of their awareness, so much of their ability to do other kinds of motions, that when we look at it from a well-rounded perspective, there probably haven't been many people comparable to wild humans on this planet.
Strength is a very hard thing to define. To me, it can be very hard to quantify. So I like the way you look at that, because one thing, a person could be a subsidized human. I like that term that you use. And they might be an Olympic runner, but what happens when you take their shoes off and put them in nature?
Exactly.
Everything changes. Everything changes. And that's something I'll ask you later, definitely, is about our feet. And when it comes to tribes being ones that have not been contacted, one thing that I always think of is Weston Price's work and looking at teeth. And you see people who are still somewhat indigenous today, and their teeth are usually, they look to be a mess. But yet, if we go back to Weston Price's time, their teeth were, they looked for the most part perfect. So it's very hard to find any indigenous cultures today that really are not interrupted or are natural. So that makes it even, you know, more of a skewed comparison, because we don't really have any truly indigenous people to compare an Olympic athlete to at this time, like you're saying. I've had a long-held belief that our immediate environment provides the perfect diet for our bodies, that really atones us body, mind, and spirit to our immediate surroundings, our immediate nature, the planetary cycles. And for me, it seems essential to spend time in that. And something I heard you mention on a podcast in the past, I forget where exactly, was that it's a good practice to find some nature close to you, you know, whether it's just a park, if that's what you have, or if it's, you know, deeper than that, and spend time there throughout the year and get to know what those cycles are, get to know nature. And it's amazing how much a person can learn just from a simple little bit of greenway. You can see how alive nature is even there throughout the seasons. I'd ask, are humans happy and healthy without hunting and gathering? It seems like that. I see a depression out there in society, and it comes from many places, but in not being connected to nature, not knowing the cycles in nature, not hunting and gathering, it seems like, you know, the human soul is missing something in body, mind, and spirit without that.
Well, I would agree, Craig. And, you know, recent surveys that look at, you know, what is the happiness of Americans and how do we compare against other countries? And the United States doesn't do poorly. We're not in the top five, you know, happiest countries in the world, but we're also not in the bottom 100 either. You know, we come in with a relatively respectable finish. But one of the things that I would politely argue is that we're actually not happy. I mean, if we want to quantify that, how can we claim that we are a happy people when 1 in 6 high school students has thoughts of suicide? I mean, this is a statistic that comes straight from the Center for Disease Control. This is a CDC statistic. And 1 in 12 high school students are reported to actually make an attempt on their life. I mean, that does not sound like a happy country of people. And I think what happens very much in the United States is a misunderstanding of what real happiness, which is in part is being content with your life. What happens here is that we have wealth, this affluence, this financial affluence that we have, and it allows us to constantly escape our life situation. We go on vacations to get away from our jobs, to get away from our neighbors. We constantly buy new things. So we kind of have this desire to be out on our landscape and find the resources that we need for living. Well, we don't do that, but we will go to the mall or we'll go online and we'll buy things. Some of the things we can use in our daily living, and they're really important. Other things are just there for a party or for a once in a while dress up. But these things make us, quote, happy. And it's really just a temporary pacification of our desire to have these new interactions with things, which used to come from being on our landscape. Now they come from the marketplace. And we see this when people who have money become unhealthy, they buy more things. And they buy more and more things, whether it be clothing or hard goods, electronics, another vehicle, whatever the case might be, they're trying to make themselves happy. But of course, we know these things are just short-term measures. They're very temporary. And happiness comes from a very different place. It comes from a community, a unified purpose, understanding your place on this planet. It doesn't come from buying things. And so I really believe that many of the statistics that we see on how happy Americans are compared with other countries have actually been asked in such a way that people get confused between buying things in the marketplace and what true happiness is.
I think that our happiness is it kind of caffeine happiness. You can drink, you know, a cup of coffee and you're happy for a little bit, but then it goes away. So you got to drink more, and then it becomes cumulative and you become resistant to it. The next thing you know, it's, you know, there's people who drink 3 pots of coffee to make it through their job every day. And that's about as happy as we get. When the hands build something organic, if you just go into the woods to find a proper piece of wood that you could make a cutting board out of for the kitchen, that is such a simple and profound deep happiness. That simple act of, you know, gathering something, finding it and creating it, sanding it, carving it, whatever you're going to do. It seems like happiness in life can come from, or the true happiness in life comes from, the most profoundly simple pleasures that connect us to our bodies, nature, spirit, everything. And it can be as simple as grinding acorn flour, or, you know, just making a cutting board, or finding like a nifty stone for your altar at home. I mean, we try too hard.
I couldn't agree more, Craig. I really think what's part of the importance of this whole discussion, because we, you know, we often focus on self, is that during this craze to buy more things, we are actually destroying the land base around us. Very few people are purchasing in a way where they're really being conscientious about, where did these goods come from? What harm occurred to those ecosystems to produce these products? And what happens to them when they reach the end of their function? In other words, what happens to them when they enter the waste stream? And that's usually not even part of the discussion, but with everything you just described, the impact is virtually zero to the world. And those things do help create happiness. I mean, we are wired to seek things on our landscape. And like we've been discussing, this has been replaced by purchasing things from the marketplace. But we're wired to have this sense of satisfaction when we gather and when we create. It's just unfortunate that the marketplace can mimic that to a degree close enough that we get confused by it and believe that we have found happiness.
Ultimately, we're still living our primal instincts just through Amazon. It reminds me of something that Joseph Campbell would talk about. Of course, everyone knows Joseph Campbell and Follow Your Bliss. And he would say that true bliss, what you're looking for, is not the jumping around game show kind of emotions. It really is the experience of life is what you're looking for. That's what real bliss is, when you actually experience life. It's very hard to do on Amazon shopping for a cutting board, which I just did. You know, go in nature and make one. You'll be so much happier. Our hunter-gatherer ancestors, they didn't walk around carrying blood meters or keto strips. And I wanted to ask you possibly your thoughts on the ketogenic diet. And we all know about, you know, the paleo ideal right now, and people saying, let's eat, you know, the paleo diet, which seems to me like it's kind of a supermarket paleo, because our hunter-gatherer ancestors went straight for the brain, the liver, you know, drinking the blood of the animal. They kind of went straight to organs, and I don't see any people who are into paleo really into eating brains.
Yeah, that's certainly true. I mean, we have a very different diet here, and even when we're trying to emulate our ancestral diet in the marketplace, we still tend to eat a huge proportion of lean muscle meat, which is in many ways the least nutritious part of the animals that we consume. The organ meats, the marrow, the broth that can be made from the bones and connective tissue and skin, all of these things were really important aspects of our original diet. And we actually know now that we get an imbalance of certain kinds of amino acids, methionine to glycine, because we're eating more lean muscle meat than the kinds of meats that would maybe be a little tough, a little sinewy, having that connective tissue in it. We tend to stay away from those because we really desire tenderness so we can cut the meat with a fork. And in the end, we're changing our diet, and we're changing the patterns of things that we used to ingest. And in doing so, research is now showing, or at least strongly suggesting, that these altered cuts of meat, or excuse me, this altered animal food that we're eating. And when I refer to that, I'm just talking about the amounts of lean muscle meat versus these other things that we've been talking about, that altered pattern of animal foods probably is inflating various things in our body, various hormones in our body that end up promoting proliferation of cancerous cells. And that's a real problem for us, because it's one of the reasons why cancer may be so high, is that even with an omnivorous diet where people are trying to be healthy, they are actually still missing the boat, because we're eating a very different ratio of lean muscle meat to these other things. But let's also be clear, when we examine hunter-gatherers around the world, we've We've actually studied the diet of hunter-gatherers to a pretty good degree. There's still many, many questions that we have, but we know a fair amount from around the world. And ketosis, or what I want to describe as chronic ketosis, where our bodies have switched from using glucose as the main energy source to ketone bodies, which are found when we cleave fats apart. That is not an ancestral pattern. That turns out to be a modern fad diet. It was long thought, you know, that far northern cultures like the Inuit and Nupiat and others were in fact in chronic ketosis because they were eating such large amounts of protein and fat and were believed to be eating very low amounts of carbohydrates. And it turns out none of that was true. The marine mammals that they were consuming store glycogen, which is essentially an animal storage form of carbohydrates. So they were actually eating a kind of carbohydrate in the muscle meat of these animals. Not to mention they have larger livers than we do, which allow them through this process called gluconeogenesis to turn more protein into glucose than we can from a temperate climate. And so through this and a number of other things, including some genetic anomalies that have been found to occur in far northern populations, these people were not in chronic ketosis as believed. And so what we know now is that the very low carbohydrate diet, this ketogenic diet, is in fact a novel, in other words, a fad diet. And while it seems to be much better than many fad diets that have been seen in modern years, it is still a new diet, and we do not know what its intergenerational effects are. I mean, certainly with its extremely low intake of plant foods, we would be missing out on a lot of plant chemistry that we know has played an important part of health in all cultures, including far northern groups who ate many more plants than people realize.
Hamburger, back in the 50s or so, used to be a way that organ meat was used. So rather than being tossed, hamburger would have heart and liver, brains, parts of the animal that we need to eat in it. And I believe that the paleo ideal, to some extent, is creating a renaissance of that.
Oh, I know families who do that, Craig, that will, they do not happen to like the taste of liver, but they have their own animals. And in the hamburger that they make, the ground beef, they will add the livers and sometimes things like heart or kidneys and grind those as well. Those organ meats are a low proportion of the total meat. And so it's not tasted, but yet it is in there. And so that's a way that they deal with those, you know, sometimes stronger flavors that come with things like liver and kidney. That's exactly what they're doing. And it is a great way to get those organ meats in the diet.
Yeah, it's something I definitely want to do because I'm still a little, when I go hunting, I can bring myself to eat the heart in the field and sometimes the brain and all, but I think I'm going to work on just bringing that home and making a hamburger. I think I could, my domesticated self could maybe palate that a little bit better if it was mixed in.
Absolutely.
When the buffalo hunters would go out, they would eat a diet strictly of just buffalo. They would just eat the choice parts of the buffalo. There was something called buffalo sickness, which is where they'd get sores on their tongue and all kinds of health problems and become very ill because they learned from the Native Americans to eat the whole thing. To go after the tongue, heart, you know, eat the blood clots out of the two big veins coming in and out of the heart and such.
I mean, we have a biological need to get more nutrition than is found just in the lean muscle meat. And we hail from a species, and I'm talking again about our wild ancestors, who consumed most of the animal. Now, certainly there were bones and hides that may not have been consumed. They may have been used for other things. But what I'm getting at is there was a much greater utilization of the animals than is found in today's marketplace in terms of diet. And we need to return to those things. And of course, those do present stronger flavors and challenges for people to make sure that they can palate them, because as you mentioned, we're used to different tastes and flavors now. But there are all kinds of great ways to incorporate these into the diet. And in fact, you still see them being offered in high-end restaurants where people have access to this great nutrition through the all kinds of things, which could include like liver pate and things where you can convert them into spreads and add other fats or dairy into them to tone down the flavors to create some, you know, nice way of bringing this to the family table.
So it seems like people eat about 30 different species of plants a year, and mostly just lean meat if they eat meat. And along with like where we're going with this conversation, I know you have mentioned that dietary diversity equals dietary sufficiency. What are some tips that people could, you know, take away from this to up their the diversity of their diet?
Well, I do think it's important that people realize that we used to eat many, many, many more plants and animals in our diet. You know, if we were to look at various groups, and some of these groups are even coming from harsh environments that constrain diversity. You know, a desert region or a far northern region have fewer species that can tolerate those conditions, and yet the indigenous people who lived in those regions still ate a greater diversity of species than we do. You know, if we were to look at, you know, say the Cherokee, at the time that they were essentially questioned about the foods that they ate, which was 1975 for this one particular study, they were reported to eat 80 species of wild plants. Now, keep in mind that by 1975, whether this is a popular concept here or not, the Cherokee were highly acculturated and would have lost a fair amount of their historical knowledge of plants, of fungi, of animals. And it's very likely that before contact, these people would have been eating well over 100 species of plants. If we look at, you know, the San Bushmen, the Zhuwasi, they were recorded to consume 85 species of plants. And that came from the 1960s, and again from an area where the climate constrains diversity. And, you know, when you look against, or you compare that against this number of species we're eating, I mean, it is very, very low. I mean, they're often eating 2 and 3 times the diversity of plants we are. And that is true also of animals. And that means that they get a greater array of beneficial plant compounds that fight inflammation, that function as antioxidants, that prevent cancer, that help our blood vessels to be strong, that keep our eyesight functioning in an acute way. All of these things come in the plant foods, but we get a much smaller amount of these, and we also get domesticated versions who have had their phytochemistry muted. Through breeding, we've toned down those strong flavors. That was an indication of how potent the plant compounds in these wild progenitors were. So this is really important that we remember that dietary diversity is our ancestral pattern, and we need to get this back. It's hard to get back in the marketplace, because if we were to go and to gather you know, certain species of plants, like if we wanted to, say, go into the marketplace and grab a whole bunch of, you know, foods from there and say, this is going to be great because I'm going to, you know, get all of these different plants. Well, keep in mind that if you were to eat, for example, broccoli and Brussels sprouts, cabbage, cauliflower, collard greens, kale, kohlrabi, that's actually all the same species. It's just different cultivated forms of Brassica oleracea. That's the scientific name of this mustard that all of those came from. And another great example, if we wanted to demonstrate how we're actually eating fewer species than we believe, acorn squash, buttercup squash, Hubbard squash, winter squash, those are all the same species of plant, Cucurbita maxima. And we can do this with many other plants. The point is we eat far fewer species than we believe, which means we get less diversity of nutrition. And part of that nutrition is the plant chemistry that comes in. So to get this back, the first thing is to start foraging. Learn how to incorporate wild plants into your diet. And there's lots of books. There's lots of teachers. They don't have to be the most amazing botanical expert on the planet and have written, you know, multiple books on the topic. There is something to be gained from lots of people who still have a little bit of that plant tradition left in their family, people who know wild greens that can be gathered from the garden or different fruit-bearing trees or shrubs. Those are great ways to pull more plant diversity into your diet. Don't forget about the spices. I mean, this is a way – the spice plants are species that we said we like your plant chemistry. It tastes pleasing to us, so we don't want to mess with that. We want it to remain potent. And so these spice plants are species that still have their phytochemical potency. They haven't been essentially muted down to our domesticated palates. So bring in these strong tasting plants, not just the spice plants, but even greens like arugula and members of the onion family like garlic. All of these kinds of things still possess their original phytochemistry. And that helps us emulate what we can do in the wild because we're bringing in plants that have nutritional potency.
I moved here to Arizona about a year ago. When I first got here, I looked at the desert and I went, oh my gosh, what a barren wasteland. And then I started to, you know, learn from the natives, you know, learn about the desert and what food is here. And I realized that I see it so completely differently now because the desert out here, literally the Sonoran Desert, it rains food on you. At first look, you go, oh, no food here. Then learn a little bit, and there's prickly pears, there's mesquite, there's endless food. It's almost impossible to starve out here any time of the year in the desert. Now, you can definitely die of dehydration pretty quick, but other than that, you are covered food-wise.
Very much.
Yeah. It's like the way it changes your perspective, and that's really a connection to self and nature, where you can say, oh, wasteland now, oh, abundance. Totally different way of seeing it. On the Art of Tracking podcast, you mentioned that you track every day. And I know for me, being a hunter, whenever I'm in nature, constantly tracking, always looking down for, well, one thing, rattlesnakes, but also for tracks. And it's so intriguing. To me, it's just essential. You mentioned you track every day. What is it that the human gets? What is it that you get from tracking, from looking at the ground and seeing what the animals are doing?
Well, we are, as far as we know, the only species that is capable of creating a story from the tracks that we see. While there are clearly other species who track, they do it in different ways. Let's look at the wolf, who is capable of tracking other animals by scent. They're following a scent. They're trailing an animal, but they're not bringing back a story to share with their group, with their tribe, with their pack in this case. Even when a dog, say, rolls in something that's decayed and very smelly, it's thought to be bringing that back to the group to say, hey, I have this carcass. This is something that we need to go to. But there isn't a story generated around how did that carcass come to be located where it is? What happened to it to cause the death of the animal? And these are all things that we can interpret from the tracks that are left on the ground, or for that matter, on branches, in the trees, and so on, because obviously signs of animal passage can be left on a variety of substrates. We have this really unique ability to build stories around the prints and the other signs that are left. And that makes us really unique. And coupled with that is this questioning, this curiosity that comes with knowing what happened here. And I mean, let's face it, humans are an amazingly curious species of animal because we don't just want to know what's happening on this planet. We want to know what's happening in the cosmos. And our imagination and our storytelling reaches out to the far edges of the universe when we're trying to recreate our past story. And so tracking is just this normal outward extension of this innate questioning that humans have always had. And it's something that we have done for a long time. It helps us build awareness. It keeps us alert. It allows us to understand who we share this landscape with, and maybe even other humans that have passed near our homes that maybe we don't want to be passing near our homes. In other words, it's an awareness of our surroundings that ultimately lets us feed ourselves and be more safe on our landscape. And it's a lost art, it's a lost science, and it's something that people really need to get back because it is fundamentally part of being human.
It seems so natural, definitely. Something I definitely would encourage people to do is, and you can track in a city, you can track anywhere. Just start, awareness can awaken anywhere you're at. You can use it. I mean, I track in my neighborhood, I track in nature. Like, once you start tracking, it will become a habit, just second nature. One last thing I'd ask, and an article you have on your site, Rewilding Fundamentals, one of the things that you mentioned is hormesis or hormesis. So we did touch on that briefly, but one thing I wanted to ask is, about is our feet are really one of our fundamental connections to this planet, to life. And it seems that a real rewilding fundamental to me that I think can make a huge difference for people is, well, to be barefoot when they can, maybe to wear leather bottom shoes when they can, or do Vibram five toes, whatever works. What do you think we're missing hiding our feet from life? And what can we awaken by getting out there barefoot, especially in nature?
Well, I like to describe it like this, Craig, and this is a really interesting topic you've brought up. What we know is that the modern footwear essentially splints the foot, and it protects it from various forces. And in doing so, much like if we were to put a cast on our foot atrophies to an extent. And then we put these very thick soles on, so that we can't feel the ground beneath us and our feet get softer. In other words, the strength of the sole of our foot atrophies. And we compact the toe box a lot so our feet really get smushed together. That's part of the splinting process. And all kinds of issues begin to arise there around the ball of our foot. And we put heels on our shoes. The heel serves no purpose. No purpose whatsoever. We believe that it serves cushioning. But in fact, because we change our gait when we run with heeled shoes, we actually, and there are studies that show this, that have examined the amount of force, and really not the amount of force, but how that force is felt by the foot. When we run with shoes, we slam down on our heel and we actually feel the weight of our body over a very brief period of time that is spread out when we land near the middle of our foot, which is how our ancestral versions of ourselves run. In other words, that midfoot running spreads that force out so the body experiences it over a longer period of time. It's less jarring. So there's all these things that are happening with modern footwear that are actually damaging our feet. At the beginning of me answering this question you posed, I said, there's a way I like to describe this to people, and it's this. If I gave you a shirt, and that shirt was so confining and rigid so that you could barely move in it, and it made your chest muscles and your arm muscles atrophy in there, and it also forced you to lean forward or backwards at kind of an unnatural position, which is what the heels do. They make it so that we're always just slightly walking downhill. That's what the heels on our shoes do, which is unnatural. And imagine this shirt that I gave you did that. It made you lean forward just a few degrees. Would anybody wear this shirt? And the answer is no. Nobody would wear a shirt that caused atrophy of their muscles, limited their range of motion, and made them lean forward. But that's exactly what our shoes do, and we're totally happy to do it. Now, to bring in that idea of hormesis, which is expanding our comfort zones through beneficially enduring low levels of stress. We're not talking about overwhelming a person, but we're talking about some mild discomfort that gradually allows us to build strength. Humans need to do this if we're going to get the strength back in our ankles and our feet. And remember, the connective tissue in our feet are ultimately attached all the way up through our legs, hips, spine, and even the back of our neck. So what we do to our feet, we do to much of the rest of our body. To get that back, we have to be willing to walk barefoot or with thin-soled shoes when it's safe for us to do so. I'm not suggesting a construction worker should step out of their leather boots. That's a place where protective footwear is needed, but we don't need to wear that all day long, all the time. And I watch people try to walk around barefoot, and they have such a hard time with it because every stone, every branch, it feels like it's coming up through the bottom of their foot because their foot is so tender from being overly protective by modern shoes for so long. But in doing so, we're causing fundamental changes to the length of our muscles and connective tissue on the backs of our legs. We're pulling on our hips, which impacts our back, just by needing to adjust our stance because our heels are elevated slightly and we need to lean back to compensate for that or we'd fall over. That's what the heels of our shoes do. They force us into an unnatural stance. So again, would we wear another piece of clothing if it manifested all these changes? No, but for some reason we were born into a society with footwear that is not really built for our body. It has all these things wrong with it, and yet we wear them because it's what we're used to, and we believe that we need a shoe with ankle support, a shoe with a thick sole, a shoe with a heel, a tight toe box, etc. And a return to barefoot walking when it's safe to do so, and minimalist shoes that have a thin sole and a number of other features that would go along with the definition of a minimalist shoe is really a very beneficial thing that helps strengthen the human body so that they can actually function on their wild landscapes again.
I know at one time you mentioned that every new plant that we come across that we work with is a skill to learn. And I think literally learning how to experience life through our feet again is a skill. Like we learn the skill of our feet once again, because I would so encourage people to do it because you actually realize how, especially walking in nature, like scurrying across stones and things like that, you become so much more careful, so much more mindful, and you realize that you actually, it's like there's these two hands that we have that we don't know about. Because when you start walking with your feet, you literally, like you reincorporate your toes and feeling, and you actually grab things when you're walking through the forest and such. When you're stepping over a stump or some sticks or rocks, you actually grab them with your toes. And it's amazing how, I would just call it maybe sloppy we become with modern footwear. We really are kind of barbaric, and we're not really experiencing nature or our bodies when we put our shoes, our feet in splints, like you mentioned.
Well, we've lost a sensory organ. Literally. We used to sense our landscape with our feet, which we could do through leather soles or plant fiber soles, whatever the case was, the footwear, because the soles, except in really cold climates where we need thick soles to protect us from the cold ground, the soles were not so thick that they couldn't still feel to some degree what was under them. And so it was another way that we sensed our environment that we have lost with modern footwear.
Are you kind of a moccasin person, or is there a diversity there?
Yeah, there's a whole diversity of things. I mean, I'm barefoot when I can. Maine, where I live, has very cold winters, so we need to protect our feet from that cold. And then I wear some type of a muckluck where there's a thick sole, but that sole is still very flexible. I can still feel things beneath my feet, even though it may be an inch thick. It's a relatively soft material. During the summer, again, here in Maine, we need protection from things like blackberry plants, which have prickles that can penetrate our skin. And so moccasins are a great choice. Any kind of minimalist sandal like unshoes and zero shoes. I mean, there's 100 different versions. But remember, I'm talking about a sandal that has a suspension system so it stays on your foot, not a flip-flop, because then I need to hold the flip-flop on by chronically curling my toes. And that's not a minimalist shoe anymore. That's forcing our foot into a position for long periods of time that it shouldn't be in. And of course, lots of people really are enjoying, the Vibram Five Fingers. I don't like their durability. I really like those shoes, but they just don't hold up that long in my experience. And then there's Vivo Barefoot. I mean, there's really great ways to do this, because there's fortunately now people who have popularized making a really cool minimalist sandal out of, you know, old tire and old pads of rubber and those kinds of things. So folks that are sort of, I don't really have the money for all of these kind of fad clothing, and I totally get it. Minimalist shoes that do all of the things that they need to do to allow your feet to strengthen can be had for really just a few dollars. It doesn't require a massive expenditure of money. It just requires a willingness to create these things and know that maybe you have to make a pair or two before you really get this thing dialed into your foot. But there are great ways to manufacture minimalist shoes for yourself.
Excellent rewilding project is make yourself some shoes, you know, be they out of leather or weaving.
They have some really amazing yucca fiber and yucca leaf footwear from your part of the world that I've seen. And it's just, it's the most fantastic craftsmanship that's, you know, unfortunately has been replaced by machines today.
Yeah, definitely. Well, yeah, you gather the plant and you dry it, then you kind of beat it with a rock, and not between two rocks, but with a rock and then on wood so you don't break the fibers, dry those, and this whole process. But something I'm working on now, and it's a lot of fun. I'm working on weaving myself some natural shoes. So we'll see how that works out. Thanks so much for your time today. What are some of the plans for the future? I hear you're building a tribe out there in Maine, and where can people get a hold of you to learn more?
Well, we are trying to form a community that's based on, again, our ancestral needs for community, like gender equality and harvest sharing, a unified purpose, land that is open and access to everyone equally, that these are all things that original communities had and more. And it's called Wilder Waters Community. You can find us, you know, interestingly enough, today, if you want to let the world know what you're doing, you need to be on social media and on the web. So we're building all those websites now. The book, A New Path, I have submitted the manuscript to the printer, and I'm about to upload the final cover artwork. And so it should be going to print literally in the next few days. They'll take about 2 months and it'll be back. So I'll be starting pre-orders soon. And people can just find those at my website. If they go to arthurhaines.com and click on Work With Me, they'll see books and it'll be right at the top. I'm hoping that the pre-orders will start within a week. And A New Path is filled with a lot of historical information and combining it with, you know, the modern science and what it actually tells us, particularly when we look through this filter of our Aboriginal life. In other words, how do we ground and truth some of the studies that we're seeing? Because we see lots of contradictory studies out there. And looking through this ancestral filter gives us a way to sort of peer through the fog of contradiction that we see so much in modern scientific study. And for people that are really excited to have a book to share with their friends, their family, like they're on this rewilding path, but they might not have the arguments that they can articulate to explain why this is important to them and why they feel it's important to their family. This is the book that's going to lay that out. in scientific writing to say, look, here's why this is important. And it will help create those arguments so that they can pass those on to their friends and family, and perhaps get those people that they love, that they care for in their life, on a healthier path of living.
This was great. This was amazing. I think this is going to go over quite
well. Yeah, thanks for inviting me, Craig. I really appreciate you bringing me on your show.
Oh, I appreciate you. Well, thanks so much. And I hope we talk again sometime. Take care.
Thanks, Craig.